A loved one taken without warning.
It sort of tips your world upside down.
A tragic accident or a brutal, calculated murder.
Why would somebody want to do that? And then suspicion started to mount.
A desperate need to secure vital clues.
We don't exactly know what's occurred. Without that, we're losing valuable evidence and we're losing time.
A fairy tale marriage. That was to be tragically cut short. In the foothills of the beautiful Derbyshire Peak District, the market town of Chesterfield is a busy commercial hub, famous for the twisted spire on its parish church.
Chesterfield is your average town. We live in a predominantly rural county. It's got your normal crime level and incidents as you would expect.
Over the years, there has been serious violence and things like that, but it is very rare to Chesterfield.
The town was home to Colette and Christopher Daffin, who grew up, met and married here in 1993.
As a family, they was happy to be together, happy in life, happy just as a normal family.
But in July 2009, their happy family life was to be shattered forever. Colette Daffin was born in 1965 and grew up with her mum Maddie and dad John, along with her brother Chris and sister Jane in the Claycross district of Chesterfield.
She was the one that had the cuts and bruises. She ought to have been a boy. She used to crack jokes and I think that come from her dad though.
Colette was like any normal child, ever so fun loving. When we had Chris and Jane, she was always the one to take them under her wing sort of thing. She was an absolutely ideal daughter. You couldn't wish for one better.
In time, Colette's parents separated and she went to live with her mum and her mum's new partner on Private Drive in the Chesterfield suburb of Hollingwood. In her teenage years, Colette met a boy and became pregnant. The relationship did not last and Colette was left to bring up her newborn son, Richard, alone.
We looked after her. She stopped here.
Colette was a real natural mother. She was so loving, as mothers are. I think she had the same difficulties as most single mums. Money were a little bit tight, but she did go to work.
Colette got a job serving behind the bar at the local pub, the Hollingwood. And it was on a night working here that Colette met Christopher Daffin. The couple got on from their first meeting and soon became a serious item.
When Colette met Chris, she seemed happy. So if she's happy, I'm happy.
I thought Chris was a fine lad. From the day we met, we never had a bad word. I'd never heard really a bad thing about him. He's a guy that you'd like your daughter to meet.
And the couple became closer still when Colette gave birth to their son, Jason. Shortly afterwards, Christopher and Colette announced they were getting married.
When she came and told me that she was getting married, I just went, whoopee, you know.
They seemed very happy together. I mean, they got married in a Methodist church at Staveley. And, you know, they were all happy and that, smiling. So, I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was a good day.
Colette was absolutely radiant on her wedding day. She was so happy. Life had taken off, I think. Everything was... Everything, I suppose, a young girl dreamed of was it was happening. She just looked so beautiful and she looked so happy.
I think to Colette, it was the happiest day of her life. She did look really happy.
Love and cherish. Till death us do part.
But on that magical day, No one could have anticipated that an early death would tragically end this beautiful marriage.
What's taking place now, you would never, ever, ever dream that would ever happen.
16 years after the couple's perfect wedding day, what appeared to be a routine road traffic collision turned out to be far more sinister. Christopher and Colette Daffin married in the town of Chesterfield in 1993. After 16 years of marriage, Colette was 43 years old. Christopher was 42. With their two children, Richard, 24, and Jason, 16, they were the picture of the regular family living on an average street. Chris was an electrician, and Colette worked alongside her mum at a local hotel.
They wanted somebody as a waitress, like, and I approached Colette and said, do you want to come work up and be with me, you know, on my breakfast shift? So she says, oh, that'd be nice, Mum. I says, well, just go up for an interview. I says, and I'm sure you'll get a job. And she did. So we were all happy together, you know, it was a good environment to work. We all got on well.
When their eldest son, Richard, moved to Cumbria for work, Colette, Chris and youngest son Jason moved to a new house on Cedar Street.
When she moved to Cedar Street, she only lived just at Opskip and a jump away from where I live. So we both found it easy to get to work because it was only a walk.
In fact, Colette's short walk to work would pass the very pub where she and Chris first met many years before. Early in the morning on the 8th of July 2009, Chris and Colette Daffin woke to an empty house. Their son Richard had moved to Cumbria for work, and their second son Jason was on holiday with family friends. Like most other mornings, they sat down to have breakfast together before going their separate ways for work. However, this morning, Chris decided that he was not going to go straight to work.
You don't mind if we go fishing, do you, this morning?
Sure.
Instead, he was going to go fishing at the local canal, just a couple of hundred yards from their home. With Chris gone, Colette got herself ready and left for work as a breakfast waitress around the usual time of 5:45 a.m. Her usual route to work was down Cedar Street, along Pine Street, and continuing down Elm Street to the Ringwood Hall Hotel. Around this time, dog walkers noticed a man behaving strangely on private drive.
Witnesses at that time, a couple of dog walkers had come forward and been identified who walked the dogs same time every day. And they'd identified something really unusual, which was a man hiding in the bushes near the Hollingwood pub wearing a grey hooded jacket and possibly sunglasses. And they'd never seen this man before, and it was unusual for somebody who appeared to be quite furtive walking away and then going back to the bushes. So his old demeanour was quite suspicious.
As she approached Pine Street, Colette received a phone call. Possibly as a reaction to this call, or distracted by it, Colette didn't turn down Pine Street as usual, but headed towards Private Drive, a slightly longer route to work.
I used to go to work a bit before Colette, because with me being supervisor, I'd got a bit first there. So she used to pull in probably about 10, 15 minutes later. She was always happy-go-lucky when she come in. She used to brighten breakfast up.
However, Maddie wasn't at work that day on the 8th of July, as she had booked a day's leave. Colette Daffin never arrived at work that morning either.
Well, as I arrived at work on the 8th of July, the first thing I was notified was that there had been a fatal RTC, a non-stop road traffic collision where the vehicle had collided with the pedestrian and driven off. So it's still a suspicious incident, something we'd treat very seriously.
When Chris Daffin arrived home at about 6:30 that morning, he received a call from one of Colette's colleagues asking him where Colette was, as she had not turned up for work.
All right. Well, she left at the normal time.
Christopher made a call to the police, and the phone call to us was very much, my wife's not turned up for work.
The police told Chris there had been an accident on Private Drive, which Superintendent Debbie Platt was monitoring.
What we do is road policing would take lead for the investigation, supported by a detective inspector. And we would lock down the road. We would try and identify the deceased, obviously.
The fact that Hollingwood was such a close-knit community meant officers at the scene were quickly able to put a name to the deceased.
There was a witness who came forward very, very close by to the actual reporting of the incident, who basically says, I know that person, I know who it is.
The body was identified as 42-year-old, mother of two, Colette Daffin.
You've then got the distressing part of this job, which is having to speak to the family face-to-face.
Hello, I'm sat in the kitchen, settee, my dressing gown, having a cup of tea, and it's not come to the door. I could see a policeman and a policewoman. And they told me that there'd been an accident. I said, where is she? He said, I'm Private Drive. I said, no, we can't, because Claire don't go that way. I can't remember anything from there.
An officer was also dispatched to inform Christopher Daffin that his wife of 16 years was dead.
Hi, Chris Daffin?
Yeah.
Can I come in a minute, please?
Yeah.
The initial family liaison officer, he went to Christopher's address. He wasn't too sure about Chris's reaction. For all intents and purposes, his wife's left to go to work and she's been involved in this collision. And there was just something that just didn't seem to be right. It didn't show that much emotion.
I appreciate that people deal with grief very differently, and he'd had the most distressing news you could possibly take. But his responses and lack of engagement were a worry.
On hearing the news of Colette's death, Chris went to call on his mother-in-law, Maddie, as news of the accident spread to other members of Colette's family.
Around about 9 o'clock, I was informed by my manager that what had happened, and he actually brought me home, and somebody else brought my car. And then I walked in the house, and I don't think for one minute there was anybody in the house. They all seemed to be outside on the patio. And I walked out to see Maddie. She was devastated, and at the time, her and Chris were sort of putting their arms around each other, consoling each other. I didn't know what to do myself. I was sort of, I don't know how to put it, really. I thought, what can you do now? And I ended up having to phone everybody up. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
He says, there's been an accident. I says, yeah. He says, it's your Colette. I says, right, I'll be over as soon as I can when I've just, I've sprint car back round. And he said, no, it's fatal. So, only thing I thought to do was ring my dad up.
I just says, how are you, Chris? Everything all right? And he says, no. And that's when the news came out. Sorry. But it sort of tips your world upside down.
He screamed. I can hear that scream now.
When he told me Colette had lost her life. Yeah, that's not good.
When I found out that it was a hit and run, I thought Chris would be absolutely fuming. absolutely fuming. Well, he's losing his wife that morning, you know, a few hours ago. We found out it's a hit and run. It's still clear in my mind now as it was over a year ago. And it won't go away. But something you'll have to learn to live with.
Detective Inspector Rick Alton was starting to piece together the events surrounding Colette's death.
The main thing that I needed to look at is setting off inquiries to actually try and locate the actual vehicle that had caused, that had been involved in the collision.
Again, a member of the local community was able to assist the police. He was travelling about 80 yards behind the offending vehicle when Colette was mowed down.
The make of the vehicle is Vauxhall Frontier, and it was like the maroon, burgundy maroon, red. We was quite fortunate to have a witness account that basically followed the Frontier down the road. As the vehicle was travelling down, it took an aggressive action towards the pavement, which again, building that in against the camber of the road would suggest to me that we was going to change this from not an average hit and run accident where somebody had been involved in a collision and then gone out of sheer shock. It was quite obvious that this was going to change to a murder investigation.
Investigations at the scene were also revealing evidence that was to become significant in the inquiry.
In the bottom of the hedgerow was part of the registration number L5, and trying to match that with the Vauxhall Frontier, and that gave us quite a significant lead in relation to tracing the vehicle.
The police national computer came up with 66 red-coloured Vauxhall Frontier vehicles with a registration starting with L5 in the Greater Chesterfield area.
An intelligence officer would obviously identify all of the 66 vehicles, identify the addresses, and then there would be actions to different officers or to different force areas to find out what movements that vehicle's taken.
One of the leads detectives followed was that 6 months earlier, a Vauxhall Frontier, matching the exact description of the vehicle that killed Colette, had been repeatedly reported as abandoned around the Clock Tower Business Centre in Chesterfield.
I was made aware that from the intelligence officer that a red Frontier had been seen at the Clockhouse Tower, which isn't too far away from the scene. And that was an abandoned vehicle report where a number of different people have rung in to say this vehicle's parked on private land, but clearly has got no MOT or tax and was causing an obstruction.
But on the day of Colette's death, searches for the Frontier in and around the Clock Tower Business Centre proved fruitless. With police believing this was now a murder inquiry, a specialist family liaison officer from Derbyshire CID was appointed to the Daffin family.
I was asked to note anything that I thought was suspicious. The time I spent with Christopher, my gut reaction was that something was not right. The behaviours he displayed, things he did, didn't seem to me to be the behaviours or the actions of a man who just found out his wife had been killed. I just remember him being distracted and looking back quite cold on that morning.
Back at the scene of the crime, further evidence was being uncovered.
Colette has obviously come to rest once the vehicle's taken off approximately where we are now, but the critical points for us as the investigating officer and me myself is the fact that in her left hand she had a mobile phone which had obviously suffered during the impact from the Frontier and it was broken in several pieces. The alarm bells start to ring, who's she been in contact with or who's tried to contact her. So for me to obtain that phone data would give me a line of inquiry to actually find out who she's been talking to and the length and time of the calls as well, which starts the investigation going and gives it some focus.
Police were about to obtain information from Colette's crushed mobile phone that could quite possibly tear Colette's family apart. The The market town of Chesterfield, lying in the foothills of the Derbyshire Dales, was home to Colette and Christopher Daffin, who married in the town in 1993. On the morning of the 8th of July 2009, Colette made her usual walk to work at the nearby Ringwood Hall Hotel. But Colette's journey was cut short at around 6 a.m. that morning when she was callously run down by a red-coloured 4x4 that failed to stop. Investigations at the scene led police to believe that this was not a road traffic accident, but a murder. And the fact Colette was on the phone around the time of her death led the police to request her phone data.
The mobile phone became very significant in itself because when we'd done some call data, it became then evident that there had been two calls from Christopher Daffin's to Colette Daffin, mobile to mobile, and Colette Daffin back to Christopher Daffin. And these calls were between 5:30 in the morning and 6 o'clock. And we believe she was killed around 6 o'clock that morning. So those four phone calls and that contact between them is very significant. And it was more significant because Christopher Daffin never told us about any of this.
However, Christopher Daffin did tell police that as part of his electrical business, he rented storage space at the Clock Tower Business Centre. The same centre where a red Frontera had been spotted abandoned in the months leading up to Colette's death.
Information came in that Christopher Daffin had got a lock-up in the Clockhouse Tower. That then became quite critical information for me, and Christopher Daffin's status as a suspect was massively raised.
Senior Officer Debbie Platt called Family Liaison Officer Nicola Clark and Detective Constable Dave Portis to the scene, where they were briefed on the latest developments by Detective Inspector Rick Alton.
One of the inquiries that I wanted Dave to do when he went to support Nicky is to obviously find Christopher. Twofold, one, to get him away from the family, because I knew which way I think this investigation is now starting to go. And secondly, to obtain his phone.
About 20 minutes past one on that afternoon, we arrived at Maddie's house, Colette's mum's. Well, Christopher left. He'd left the house and he told them he was going to walk the family dog and he'd gone home. So our next move, obviously, was to go to 5 Cedar Street, the marital home of Christopher and Colette Daffin.
I'm DC Dave Portis. Can we come in and talk to you?
I asked him questions about his movements that morning and I told him that we wanted his telephone. The only real questions he asked back were why we wanted the telephone. There were no other questions, really. And I just explained to him that everything had to be looked into. It was a very serious incident and we needed to look at his phone. I stepped outside the premises and left Nicky with Christopher Daffin, and I telephoned Rick Alton, the DI. I explained to him I got the telephone, the mobile phone. I also told him that something didn't seem right. He was too calm. He wasn't cut up at all about what had happened. Something wasn't right. Something just wasn't right.
Chris, I want you to accompany us to the police station.
It made a decision to bring Christopher Daffin back to Chesterfield Divisional Headquarters. To get details of what had happened to him that morning, what his movements were and where he'd been, and what he knew about Colette's movements. He agreed to this, and we set off and we came back to Chesterfield Police Station.
There was concern around how he was behaving with the family liaison officers. There was concern around the vehicle was still outstanding. We still hadn't identified the red Frontera. We knew that Christopher Daffin had got a lock-up at the Clock Tower. We could put an abandoned red Frontera, similar number plate, to the Clockhouse Tower. And we knew that we weren't dealing with a non-stop collision at that point. If a woman dies in this country, the vast percentage die at the hands of a partner or husband.
But if this was to prove to be a domestic murder, it was not following the usual pattern of events associated with this type of crime.
The issue with domestic homicide, there generally appears to be an escalation of risk before. somebody would have called, whether it was a neighbour, whether it was the victim, to report domestic abuse. The unusual factor in this case is that there was no history of domestic abuse reported to the police.
On the contrary, descriptions of Colette and Chris Daffin given to the police were of a very happily married couple.
And that, for me, was quite an unusual factor if we were considering him a suspect. Part of me would have anticipated that there would be something there, a motive or something around previous domestic violence within that household, and there didn't appear to be anything.
With no previous knowledge of Christopher Daffin, it was vital that police build a picture of who he was and, more precisely, an account of his movements that morning.
Christopher Daffin told me that himself and Colette had slept together that night. They got up in the morning at 5 o'clock. He'd left the house at 5:15 and he was going to go fishing. So he went to the canal, which is local, only a few hundred yards from where they live, really. He said that there'd been telephone calls and texts between himself and Colette whilst he was at the canal. Something about an errand, she wanted him to run for bread, and that's as much as he said, really. And then, following that, he'd got back home and received a telephone call from Colette's boss at work, and telling him that she'd not arrived for work. So Christopher said he rang the police. He was told that there had been an accident and somebody would come and see him. He also said that he walked from his house at Cedar Street to the scene, or to the where the scene was taped off from, where he was met by uniformed police officer. He explained who he was to the officer, and the officer took him home. Very shortly after that, I believe, the message was passed by officers that Colette was involved in the accident.
They phoned me once he got down to the police station and basically gave me just a brief account of what Christopher's initially saying, and there was no sign of him going fishing. Nobody had seen any fishing tackle, and if he was fishing when that had, you know, when he had the news, it was a very short fishing trip. I'm local to this area. I know Chesterfield very well. I do a lot of mountain biking, and I do that route sometimes down there along the canal at Hollingwood. And I know where he's saying he was fishing, that there isn't a signal down there. It just increases my suspicions around whether his account is actually true or not.
With D.I. Alton convinced Chris was lying about where he was at the time of the phone call to Colette, the police decided to take a dramatic step in the investigation.
About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, possibly a bit later, myself, D.I. Alton, who's the deputy SIO, we sat in a police van and we were just reviewing the evidence, and the picture was obviously building around Christopher Daffin. And obviously to arrest anybody is a serious step and not one that you would ever take lightly. You run through a whole series of questions in your mind, because the impact for this family, if I arrest an innocent man, would possibly be catastrophic. Because not only have we told this family that the mother's died, that their daughter's died, but we're now also going to have to go back and inform them that the man we've arrested is the dad, is their son-in-law, is their son. And that's a really difficult decision to make. But the evidence was stacking up overwhelmingly against Christopher. And it's my duty to account for Colette's death.
And that's when it's the decision, yeah, arrest him for the murder. And although, and you say it now, it's quite easy to say, but within that van, there was quite a lot of pressure. Because as soon as we make that decision, not only is it going to focus our investigation in relation to Christopher, what we have to bear in mind as well is that it's going to tear that family, potentially tear that family apart.
We hadn't located the vehicle. Christopher Daffin wasn't wearing a grey hooded top at the house, so there were obviously key pieces of evidence missing. But my view was that there was too much suspicion not to arrest, and we needed then to secure the house, the vehicle. He'd got a couple of vehicles on his drive anyway. And that, for me, became a key line of inquiry.
The The decision to arrest Christopher Daffin only 7 hours after the death of his wife, Colette, was even a surprise to the investigating officers taking Chris's statement in Chesterfield Police Station.
As I was taking the statement, we got approximately a page and a half through the statement, and I received a phone call from the I. Alton again. So I obviously left the room.
I'm speaking to Dave Porters over the phone and basically instructed him that this is what we want to do. Christopher's to be arrested on suspicion of the murder of his wife. And there was a bit of a pause. Then the pause went on a bit longer. And I basically had to say to Dave, did you hear that? And he come back and it was quite obvious that Dave was shocked.
I was taken somewhat by surprise, but I went in, when I got some details off of Rick in relation to the phone calls, not tallying with what he was telling us, and other information that had come to light from witnesses, I went into the same room and I arrested him on suspicion of the murder of Colette.
What? You do not have to say anything?
The only thing he says was something like, what? And that was the only emotion I saw from him. He never said another word. He never spoke another word. If I told him to follow me down to the custody suite, which he did. I led him down there. He never asked a question. He never said a word.
Following the arrest of Christopher Daffin, it was Nicola Clark's job to tell Colette's family that Chris was being held in custody as a suspect in her murder.
As a police officer, having to turn up at the family home and inform the immediate family members that we, as the police, had now arrested a husband who they trusted with the care of their daughter, it was a difficult thing to have to do. And their initial reactions were that they didn't want to believe.
Maddie was very... found it very hard to believe at that time that he could possibly do something like that. And she didn't want to believe it. But, I don't know, it's... Neither of us wanted to believe it.
I read on the news that they arrested a 42-year-old man on suspicion of Colette's death. Never in a million years did I think it was Chris that night.
I knew they'd got the wrong man. I mean, why would they arrest Chris? So, of course, I thought, well, he'll be released very shortly. Then we'll have a chat.
With Chris Daffin now in custody, police could secure his and Colette's property and search it thoroughly for evidence to link him to the crime. They were also keen to establish a motive.
The home address was sealed as a scene. There was two vehicles on the driveway, one of which was a white Vivaro van. Again, that was sealed as a scene. And we also locked down the lockup that Christopher used at the clockhouse tower, and then set the parameters of what I was asking staff to specifically look for. And certainly from the home address search, I was looking for a motive.
Is this a domestic dispute that's gone totally, totally wrong? And it's been done out of sheer frustration, pressure? Is it financial? Is there anybody else still out there that could be involved? Bearing in mind with somebody lurking in the bushes.
Searches within the house retrieved financial documents which police hoped might point to a possible motive, while officers beginning a search of Chris Daffin's work van were about to make a significant discovery.
Myself and two other officers got to Cedar Street. Our intention being to search a Vauxhall van which he used for his work as an electrician. And as we removed items from the car and van, they were to be photographed.
I receive a call from the search team that's responsible for the search of Christopher's van, and with what they told me, it did blow my mind to a certain extent. They've recovered items of clothing which matched the description of the man that was alleged to have been in the hedgerow near to the scene, and also underneath that a V5 document which related to a Vauxhall Frontiera with the registration which started with L5. So quite hard to believe at that time. And I think after I'd put the phone down from the search advisor, it was very much sit back and have I just listened and heard what he's told me.
The V5 logbook directly linked Chris Daffin to a vehicle that matched the description of the one that brutally mowed down his wife. And the clothes found in his work van were identical to those worn by the man seen acting suspiciously at the scene immediately before the murder.
The fact that we found the old doll with the V5 document and the clothing did feel like a vindication for making the arrest, but you never make such an arrest on a wing and a prayer. You've got to have the courage of your convictions in this type of investigation, but we still needed to find that frontier. It got to be somewhere local, and that would be the critical piece of the jigsaw.
And the person the police thought could help locate the Frontera was about to be interviewed by Detective Constables Dave Portis and Mandy Shunburn at Chesterfield Police Station.
It was after 10 o'clock that night we began the first interview with Christopher Daffin. Wanted to know about his family life, but by this time he'd taken advice from his solicitor and he maintained a no-comment interview. Every question that was asked, he replied, no comment.
If you're genuinely an innocent individual, you would be crying out to be heard in that police station and you would be given us your movements and alibis and people who could assist, and we just got no comment after no comment after no comment.
No comment.
And although, you know, that's a person's perfect entitlement to do that, I just also think it's an indication of guilt of an individual.
When somebody decides to go no comment, although the interviewing officers are very frustrated, I'm frustrated because the family are asking us questions around what's happening and we can't give them an account.
Time was running out and the police required cast iron evidence to charge Chris Daffin with the murder of his wife. They needed to find the murder weapon, the red 4x4, and that breakthrough would come the following day. On the morning of the 9th of July 2009, Colette Daffin's husband Christopher was in custody in Chesterfield. He was being held on suspicion of her murder by running her down in a red 4x4 the previous day. Colette's family found it impossible to believe her husband had killed her.
We thought Chris was a victim. Even how bad I felt, I thought, well, God, he must feel... Well, it's ripped my heart out. How was he going to feel?
But Colette's sister Jane had information that would rock the family.
She came and she started saying that she knew about the affair he'd been having with this other woman. And Colette had asked her not to say anything.
It was just horrific, hearing all that. So as well as losing my sister, I might say my mum and dad losing their daughter, we have to hear all this.
We'd had information into the investigation team that Christopher Daffin was having an affair, and obviously that did become a line of inquiry in its own right. We arrested the other woman. She'd clarified that there had been a relationship over a number of years, that it had been an on-off relationship, and that it had finished, and that she had no idea whatsoever of his intention to kill Colette. And with her movements and an alibi from other people, we were quite clear that she hadn't been involved in the preparation or the actual act of murder.
Christopher Daffin wouldn't admit that he'd been having an affair. He says he was friendly with this woman, but he wouldn't have it that he was having an affair. It's strange, but when asked if he was having an affair with this woman, he denied it. But when asked if he'd murdered Colette, he went no comment.
Police had arrested Chris less than 7 hours after Colette's death. Subsequent searches of Chris's work van had revealed clothes similar to those worn by a man acting suspiciously at the scene, and a logbook belonging to a red-coloured Vauxhall Frontera, the vehicle used in Colette's killing. A vehicle that the police had yet to trace.
The frustration that we're feeling, because this car is still outstanding, you know, we've looked at everything. We've looked at the intelligence systems. We've looked at AMPR, the number plate recognition system. We've looked at speed cameras. We've had the helicopter up doing all the surrounding area. We've even gone to the extent of asking the fire service, not just in this county, but other counties, if they get any burnt out vehicles.
The car is critical because it's actually the murder weapon that was used to murder Colette. And by finding the vehicle, hopefully we will then have forensics on the vehicle that would connect Christopher to the inside of the vehicle and Colette, sadly, to the outside of the vehicle.
Once again, it was a member of the public that came forward with vital information.
A call comes into the police and it's basically a woman local to the community. She's heard about the incident because of how close the community is, and she's walking down a pathway at the back of a club that's waiting to be knocked down. It's totally derelict and stuck right underneath the club in like an open garage is the Vauxhall Frontera. So this is what used to be the Trofley Club, and the day after the murder, this is where the Vauxhall Frontera was found.
Detectives found petrol and gas canisters in and around the Frontera. They believe it was Chris Daffin's intention to return to the vehicle at an opportune time and, by igniting the canisters, explode both the car and the derelict club, totally destroying any evidence held within it.
For us as an investigation team, that would have been quite a critical point for us, because a lot of the evidence that we found from the vehicle would have been lost within the fire and obviously buried under, as you can see, quite a large amount of the rubble.
DNA and forensic evidence in and around the Frontera undisputedly linked Chris to the vehicle, even down to the shoes he wore on the day of the murder.
The decision to make that early arrest was, in my mind, validated completely, because had we not, we would have lost critical evidence. If Christopher Daffin hadn't been locked up on the 8th, we would potentially have lost the evidence in the white Vivaro van, the grey hooded top, the V5 document, and definitely the Frontera vehicle. So, you know, in terms of justifying that arrest and feeling that, you know, it was the right decision to make at that time, you can look back now and think, yeah, it was the right decision to make.
So the decision then is made to charge Christopher in relation to the murder.
Police submitted their evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service. And just before 1 a.m. on the morning of the 10th of July 2009, less than 48 hours after Colette Daffin's death, her husband, Christopher Daffin, was charged with her murder.
Charges are on the 8th of July 2009 at Chesterfield in County Derbyshire, murdered Colette Daffin, Constable Common. Did you make a little light of that, Charlie?
I didn't do it for Christmas Day.
When I heard about all this, I thought I could read people so well. I know he wasn't like that initially. He was happy, it just deteriorated to this stage. Once he messed about with other women, there's no room for three in the marriage.
But detectives were about to uncover the real motive behind Colette's murder.
The specialist departments that we have that can look deep into people's finances. There's one of the financial investigators, Mark, with just an A4 piece of paper, and shaking it with a great smile on his face and puts it on the desk and says, look at that. Well, to me, I basically said, well, what am I looking at? Because it's an insurance policy for £250,000.
Life insurance had been taken out on Colette Daffin for a figure far greater than any other previous policy. And police had concerns regarding the authenticity of the signature on the policy.
It came back from the forensics at Birmingham, which basically says that that is not Colette's signature. Which again, when you sit back and you think, this has obviously been planned over a considerable period of time. Again, that gives you your motive.
With overwhelming evidence stacked up against him, Christopher Daffin eventually pleaded guilty to the murder of his wife, Colette. On the 7th of April 2010, Chris Daffin appeared at Nottingham Crown Court for sentencing.
When the judge sentenced Christopher Daffin to 25 years for murder, it's a mixed emotion, really. You know that your decisions, your investigations have been sound and that's been justified in a court of law. But you're also conscious you sat in that courtroom and there are numerous family members and friends there. And so it's a mixed emotion, really.
She was my daughter and friend. I rolled into one. I just feel lost. Part of me ripped away. It'll never mend. Nobody knows what it's like for a mother to have to bury a child.